All right, welcome everyone to our fourth Academic Life in Emergency Medicine Annals of Emergency Medicine Journal Club. First of all, I'd like to thank Drs. Jeff Klein and Jonathan Kirshner for taking time out of their busy schedules to join us today. Today we're going to be talking about the ADJUST PE trial, which was just published in JAMA this year, actually in March of this year. And Sam, could you just give us a brief rundown of the article before we get started with the questions?
Yeah, sure, Salim. So this was a prospective, multi-center, multinational outcome study. It took place in 19 centers in Belgium, France, the Netherlands, and Sweden. And what they were looking at, they were evaluating an age-adjusted cutoff for the D-dimer for patients over the age of 50. So essentially, the 8 plus 10, it was the adjusted cutoff equation. For example, a 60-year-old patient would have a cutoff level of 600 instead of the normal 500.
Got it. Thanks for setting that up for us. Well, I don't want to keep our guests waiting anymore. Like I said, they were nice enough to grace us with their presence to answer some of these questions that we had on the Journal Club this week. So, Sam, why don't you go ahead and kick us off with the first question, and we'll see what everyone has to say.
Okay, for question one, we asked, the median age of this study population was 63 years old, which is older than most American populations which are tested for PE. What effect might the older population studied have on the diagnostic accuracy of the D-dimer assay? And what effect might the older age have on the overall findings of the study?
Jonathan, why don't you go at that?
Sure. So, you know, Jeff, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the average age in U.S. study populations tends to be much more middle age, in the mid-40s is typically the average age. So this is almost a 20-year difference in your average age of the study population. This is probably going to affect the calculated sensitivities from the study. The reason lies really in what we call spectrum effects, often called spectrum bias. But essentially, when the severity of a disease lies across a continuum or a spectrum, as is true in pulmonary embolism, the more severe presentations will be a little bit easier to identify for a diagnostic test. And this is probably true as well for D-dimer. So if you have a patient spectrum that is sicker in general, you're probably going to have a higher sensitivity when comparing the exact same test in a population where the spectrum of disease is less severe. And age is a direct correlate with severity of disease, at least in terms of prevalence of pulmonary embolism. The prevalence is significantly higher as we age, and sometimes, you know, tenfold higher between a middle-aged population and elderly population. You know, that can certainly affect the way the test performs, and that was, for me, one of the more significant issues with this study. Jeff, did you have anything else on that one?
So PE seems to behave differently in Europe than it does in the United States. Just for example, if you look at the Denexter study that was published in Blood that examined the outcomes of subsegmental PE, he found the same mean age of the people with subsegmental PE as had larger PE, again, around 60 years of age, a full standard deviation above the mean age that we diagnose PE in the United States. However, in the United States, if you look at the difference between subsegmental and segmental or larger PE, the subsegmentals occur in small and younger people, more like in the age of 40s versus the larger PEs. So the data in the United States really support what you're talking about, Jonathan, which is that the older people have bigger PEs that are easier to pick up at the D-dimer. So you might be right. We might see a few more false negatives in the United States. That is possible. I still think they'll be small PEs and don't necessarily need to be treated. The one other thing is there's just fewer older people here, so that the incremental advantage that they saw in Europe might be a little less, meaning that there's less rule-out power of that age times 10 here than there would be there. Still, I think it's ready for prime time, and it's the right thing to do.
All right. Swami, what you got for us for the next question?
Yeah, so let's tackle number two. So we asked, although all of the D-dimer assays used in this study had the same cutoff of 500 micrograms per liter for an abnormal value, many other quantitative D-dimer assays have different cutoffs of abnormal. So what is the basis for the difference in the cutoffs, and can the results be translated for the D-dimer that was used here to the D-dimers that we're using in the U.S. or in our shops?
Let me take a stab at that. I think that's one of the biggest problems we have here. It seems to be echoed by a survey that we did of about 950 emergency physicians. On average, they rated this as a significant problem to patient safety. The problem is that somewhere around half of D-dimers that are used for PE have a different threshold than 500 nanograms per ml. Now, interestingly, out of all of the studies or all of the assays that are approved by FDA, most of them have a cutoff of 500, those that have an indication for use for diagnosis exclusion of VTE, all except one, and that's the Hemosil assay, which is a 230 nanogram cutoff. So what's left to be found is whether we can take like the Hemosil assay and just do age times 5, for example. But that hasn't been done yet, so it leaves a question for a lot of people out there with D-dimer assays that don't cut off at 500 and cut off at a lower point. Remember, a lot of those, by the way, are not cleared by FDA for diagnosis exclusion of VTE, but your pathologist has decided to use it anyway.
I think what was very interesting from that survey you mentioned, Jeff, was that 80% of physicians didn't know what assay their department was using. They really have no ability to determine if their assay was similar to the one used in this study, if the results could be applicable to them as well. You know, I think it's important to know what test you're using if you're going to choose to use an age-adjusted cutoff, and starting with just looking at your own lab and get that background information.
Exactly. I think a lot of people don't know what to do when they see micrograms per milliliter rather than nanograms per milliliter. That is just another tenfold confusion for many people.
Thanks, guys. Swami, you also had one other issue that comes up at your shop. So you work at 3 different hospitals, I think I remember you telling me, and you were telling me that they use like different cutoffs for your D-dimer to compare like for DIC versus VTE. What question did you have on that?
Yeah, so what we noticed is that we had different cutoffs at each place. So we emailed, you know, we asked our hematology guys, the guys who were in the lab, and said, you know, why are we having different cutoffs? Do we have different assays at the different places? Interestingly, they told us, no, it's the same assay at all 3 places, but at each different location, it's the person in the pathology department or the person in the lab who's setting the cutoff. And I asked them, you know, what are we setting this cutoff for? Because most of the stuff we read is a 500 cutoff, not this 230. And I said, well, that's looking for PE, but that's not what we're using the study for. They're looking for things like DIC and other hematologic disorders. So again, it speaks to what Jonathan said. A lot of people don't know what they're using, and they don't know what the indication is that the lab has set for that cutoff. So the question sort of was, you know, how do we do a better job of communicating to emergency physicians who are working what our cutoff is and what we should be using and what that means?
Well, I think that really does speak to the need for a normalized level for your D-dimer assays, and really just need to change the standard so that these results are transportable. Many people work in multiple hospitals, and again, it's difficult to remember what's the correct cutoff and where you should use it. And you're right, that DIC cutoff is certainly adds to the confusion.
A lot of hospitals will get their own reference range of normal plasmas, run their D-dimer on it, and their pathologist will set a cutoff based on that. One of the reasons they do that is it's clear requires them to do that, and it gets really confusing when they impose their own cutoff and then print it out on the document, and medical legally you think, oh, I've got to use that number. It's also even worse that different, like a same D-dimer company might put out more than one assay. I mean, for example, Tenaquant puts out 2 different assays with 2 different cutoffs. So your different hospitals may have the same name of the device, but an actual different antibody. So it has layers of complexity that lead to problem. And I think the FDA needs to get on this and impose a rule that requires something like an INR or D-dimer. Although FDA's position is we can't tell companies what to do, so it really has to come a grassroots effort from people like us to tell the companies to force them to do it. FDA actually doesn't have the power to, but they can certainly give what's called industry guidance for future D-dimers. But those that are out there, the only way they're going to change is by pressure from consumers.
So, Jeff, just as a clinician, I think that the idea of a normalized ratio for a D-dimer is a very intriguing idea. Is it possible to do that with the technology that we have now? Like, is that like a doable thing that could be done? Or is it going to require some investigation and bench research before it can be implemented?
Well, think about it. These antibodies are all capturing the same protein. The protein doesn't differ. It's just that they're using epitopes that have different affinities and bind to different parts of the protein, and so they get different standard curves. Sure, they can all do it. They have to do a little bit of work. They have to do some standard curves, and they could put a correction into their computer software that all normalizes it right to 500 or to 1,000 or to a ratio. You know, whatever we decide makes the most sense for us. We actually put it in the survey, what would you like to have this normalized to? And everyone said, dead to 1, just like the INR. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I personally would just go 500 since we really have this paper out there. The age times 10 seems to be catching on. But it looked like from the survey, most people wanted something even simpler. Like, tell me 1.0 is a cut is abnormal, and we go from there.
All right. So for our third question, I'll go ahead and go with this one. Basically, we're talking about prevalence of disease in the study population and how that will directly affect the derived positive and negative predictive values, or the so-called post-test probabilities. So the prevalence of PE in this study was approximately 19%. How does that number compare with prevalence of PEs performed in other countries? And we kind of alluded to this a little bit earlier. Jeff, I believe you had mentioned something about that. And how does prevalence of disease in this study population affect our sensitivity and specificity for this diagnostic strategy?
Jonathan, I think you're the man for that.
Sure. So in the U.S. populations, we often see prevalence in the U.S. studies closer to 5%, up to 10%, but oftentimes in the single digits. So this represents, you know, maybe nearly a fourfold increase in prevalence. We're uncomfortable using predictive values derived from these studies because we know that they vary with test prevalence very simply. You know, prevalence is really looking at right number of people with disease. As the true positives increase, or the more people with the disease increase, you're just going to get an artificially inflated negative and positive predictive values. So we don't like to use these predictive values derived from the tests to transport to other populations. They'll be useful in the study population. That's why we prefer sensitivity and specificity, and then from that calculating likelihood ratios. Unfortunately, we don't have the information in this study to calculate positive and negative likelihood ratios because we don't really know how accurate the positive D-dimers were, the D-dimer tests that were above the age-adjusted threshold. So we don't know that information. We can calculate a range. However, in fact, sensitivity and specificity are also not stable depending on prevalence. So, for example, as we discussed earlier with the age question, as the prevalence increases then and the severity and spectrum of the disease worsens or increases, the performance of that diagnostic test will again change. And in fact, the higher prevalence will again overestimate the sensitivity. So it will really produce a very good rule-out test, whereas if used in a lower prevalence population, it may not be as highly sensitive and it may not be as good of a rule-out test.
And I just wanted to mention one more thing. So I think on the blog for Academic Life and Emergency Medicine, Anton Hellman, I guess he's a ER physician up in Canada, and he had mentioned that in the original Wells landmark study that the prevalence of PE in Canada, although an older trial, was closer to 9.5%. And so that's kind of closer to that 5 to 10% range you're quoting for the U.S. And this study was 19%. And it looks like, depending on what studies you look at in Europe, it can be anywhere from low to mid-20s up to the 30% range.
That's right. And if you look at their studies, their prevalence is coming down. And in a few years, it'll be in the teens. And I remember talking to Mark Regini about 10 years ago, and he said Europe would never see prevalences in the teens. And they are seeing them in the teens, and I think they're going to continue to go down as they become more Americanized in the way they use emergency departments. Mm-hmm. Remember, in Europe, they used to have this high esteem of being a family practice or general practitioner where you went and took care of your town. And they made pretty good money. They worked hard, but they were really held in high esteem. But young people don't want to do that job anymore. So they're losing their primary care circuit that was so strong and powerful for many, many, many decades. And they're becoming much more Americanized and more dependent on their emergency departments. You can just see them become more with lower and lower prevalences. The next study they do, I bet, will be 15%, and soon it'll be below 10.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but it's the usage of the healthcare system that's driving these numbers. People are getting included in these studies because they're emergency or hospital-based trials. And so there's more people going to the hospital rather than getting care from the community. And that's what the change in the percentages is from. Is that correct?
That's my hypothesis, is that if you go and hang out in a French emergency department, which I've done with my friend Pierre-Marie Waugh, where my daughter used to go spend the summers at his home, and his daughter would come spend her summers at our home. We did a daughter switch. If you go there, many of the patients that come in for PE workups were referred by doctors. A lot of them have already had a D-dimer when they get to the emergency department. But that is changing. They are much more getting more like where people come off the street because they're not feeling as well today as they did yesterday. And they're facing what we face in the American emergency departments. So I think we'll see their prevalence come down. But for now, I think that they've done the best D-dimer adjust study that can be done, and I think it's ready for prime time in the United States, despite the differences in populations.
Teresa, also addressing your question, I'm curious if it's also an issue of values differences between the different regions, meaning is the values more focused on eliminating overdiagnosis and overtreatment? Are they comfortable with a greater degree of uncertainty? It seems in the United States what we're striving for is zero. With imperfect tests, we're not going to get to zero without harming a decent number of people along the way. So my bias is frequently that the values in the United States is to eliminate all risk, and other countries seem to have a little bit less risk aversion. But again, this is only my hypothesis.
I have to say, that was actually the thing that was surprising about the comments from Canada, that their rate's pretty close to ours. I would have thought that they would have been more like the European model, more with a higher prevalence in their population than we are. I thought they'd be less risk-averse. I'm sorry, more risk-averse than we are, but, you know, I'm kind of surprised. And unfortunately, I think what Jeff is saying means that we're all sort of coming down to this very much lower prevalence, so we're all going to be over-investigating as things shift. It's very disconcerting. I was kind of hoping that we'd go the other way, but obviously that doesn't seem like it's what's going to happen.
I mean, one of the things to know as the token Canadian on the panel is that we do love our D-dimers. So we do like to use them in low-risk populations, and we do see a lot of undifferentiated chest pain because people love emergency departments. So as opposed to our emergency visits are far outweigh American ones and European ones. So part of the reason why the number is lower is because it's a proportion of a much bigger denominator, if you know what I mean, because Canadians love their emergency departments. And they'll come to us preferentially over their family doctor, over primary care walk-in clinics. Like, they just love it. And it's definitely a cultural thing, and that's going to change the numbers as well, right? So if you look at absolute numbers, it might not be, but when you look at relative visits versus people, it's also a very different phenomenon.
More evidence that the Canadians are too polite.
We're not mean enough to them at the door, maybe. I don't know. And we don't charge the money, so that's a big part of it, too.
You'd be more rude like we are.
I think that's why Jeff's insights are really great, because what we're seeing is I think I always thought, and I'm sure a lot of American physicians always thought, the reason why we're having so many of these subsegmental, these low-risk patients that we're investigating is because we were worried about all the medical legal issues. But what Jeff is sort of saying is that this is actually a failure of primary care. So in a place where you have a little bit better of a primary care system, where people are being screened better outside before they come to the emergency department, you see a higher prevalence overall because you're investigating higher-risk people. Whereas we're not getting that screening before they come in. It sounds like the same thing in Canada. These patients are coming in right off the street, not having seen anyone, not being referred. Very different population that we're addressing, not just for PE, but a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you talk to Kirsten Hogg, who came and spent time with me in Charlotte and is now up in Ottawa and is a fellow up there, that Canada's kind of in between the two. It's not as bad as inner city United States, but not like Europe. It's a little bit more primary care in Canada.
All right, I'm going to move us along here. So that was some great answers, great hypotheses. I always wondered why there was a prevalence difference between the two areas, but thank you, Jeff and Jonathan, for that. So Swami, what's our fourth question?
Sorry, so question number four here. So we asked, basically, would you change your practice based on this study, assuming that you had one of the six study D-dimer assays? For instance, you see a 60-year-old woman with a non-high pretest probability of PE, and you get a D-dimer, and that D-dimer comes back at 590. Would you then perform a CTPA on that patient, or would you discharge her home and say, you know, it's very unlikely that you have a PE?
So I'm comfortable using the age-adjusted D-dimer cutoff, although maybe not only based on this study result. So this single study for me is maybe not enough. But in addition to the larger numbers of retrospective results that we've seen from other publications, which align with the high sensitivity of this approach in the Adjust PE trial, I do use the age-adjusted cutoff. Now, where I work at Methodist Hospital in Indianapolis, we use the Hemosil assay, and that's the one that uses D-dimer units and has a cutoff of 230. And so the question then is, well, do I do the age times 5 cutoff? And the answer is yes, but with some caveats. And a number of the posts from the Allium website had similar feeling, which was, I'm going to look at my patient and determine if I think that they're low risk. And if they're in the low risk range, I'll probably use an age-adjusted cutoff. And if they're in sort of the high end of my non-high probability, I might be a little bit more concerned using age-adjusted cutoff, but I'm still most likely going to use it. And ultimately, I'll have a shared decision-making conversation with my patient and let the patient make the call.
Jonathan, can I ask you a quick follow-up question to that? Because I'm intrigued by your thought that based on the retrospective studies and now with this prospective cohort study, you're convinced by the body of evidence now. But looking at this study, it was a study of 3,324 patients. But instead of the patients in that group that met the actual study population of interest, so it was only about 330, 10% of their total population that were actually the ones that you did the age-adjusted D-dimer to. Does that make this a really small study is that why you kind of said you got to interpret it with the body of evidence rather than saying this is the sealed deal study?
Absolutely. I mean, the 3,000 number is a little bit misleading in the sense of that's all patients that were evaluated, and that included a number of high probability patients based on the two-level Wells score or revised Geneva score. So that was a large number of patients that were actually questioning, and we really want to focus on the patients that we have this question about. It's the non-high probability patients, and of that subset, 300 had the, around 300, I think 330 maybe, had that D-dimer below the age-adjusted cutoff. In addition to those numbers, not just the total number of patients is important, the number of events is important as well. So when you only have one miss out of 330, that's not a large number of events, and that tells you one of two things. Either we need to do this study in a larger population, try to capture more events, because we misclassify one patient, that doubles the event rate. So that's concerning too for me, is the number of events that are so small, and that's why I'd like to see a larger study to feel more confident. That being said, in my already non-high-risk patient, I'm already less concerned, and now I feel that I'm still having a relatively high sensitive test. Even if the sensitivity is not quite as high as reported by the ADJUST-PE trial, I still feel that it's adequately high to not proceed with a further testing with a CT pulmonary angiogram.
So it sounds like you're playing your pretest process probability odds and bringing your patient into the conversation. Is that
yeah, right? The clinical gestalt is still king. It's still the best thing that we use, still the most important part of the workup of PE.
So I'd like to ask one more thing with that, and this wasn't my comment. This was a comment that was made on the blog, was that there were 7 deaths that were associated out of that 331 patients, and I guess they went back and said only one of them was due to venothromboembolism. And then they came back and said 3 of the other 6 were due to COPD by adjudication, but there was no, they didn't go to for autopsy to have those evaluated. So they were just a committee or a panel of people who retrospectively went back and said 3 of those 6 were due to the COPD and not the venothromboembolism itself.
Yeah, and these are the same people that say that 1 in 3 people with a COPD exacerbation has a PE, which is totally not right. So, yeah, I mean, who knows? It's possible, but they did the best you could do. I think this study is, nobody's going to have the money or the ability to do one that's larger. And, we're going to have to make decisions with some degree of ambiguity. This is the right decision to make when the real question is, do I want to rule out PE in someone that's 70 years old, and that's the one thing I care about. Let me make sure everybody hears this. If we take CTPA scans done in the emergency department, what's the most common emergent diagnosis the CT scan makes? It's pneumonia, about 10%. PE is somewhere around 6 or 7%. There are many 70-year-olds that you want a CT scan on to figure out what's wrong with them. I'm not sure that this D-dimer is going to save a whole lot of CT scans in the United States, because I think these old people get CT scans anyway. This is a topic for another journal club, but I think the place to increase the D-dimer concentration is in young people with low pretest probability. Those are the ones that don't need the radiation, and those are the ones that don't need these subsegmental PE diagnoses. So in the United States, I think it's actually the other way. Younger people, low pretest probability, need their D-dimers elevated in terms of the threshold.
And then I'd like to end this journal club with one more thing, Jeff, if you don't mind. You had recently tweeted out an algorithm that you were kind of advocating for. I don't know if Michelle is still listening, but I'd like to see if we can pop that up on the screen. If you don't mind, just maybe talking us through that.
Okay. This is a algorithm that I'm going to, I hope, published in a review that I've written. I've enlisted the help of my colleague Chris Cabral to do some editing work on this paper. It's called the exclusion and diagnosis of pulmonary embolism in the emergency department, and I'll draw your attention to the left-hand side of the screen. I think that we use Gestalt in the emergency department. That's what drives the Wells score. So if you have a Gestalt pretest probability that is less than 15%, meaning I think there's less than a 15% chance this patient has a PE, then go to the PERC rule. If PERC rule is negative, there's no PE. And if it's positive, move right down to an age-adjusted D-dimer. And right there, I think we will exclude a non-zero percent more, an incremental more percent of patients. And in the U.S., it will be a little less than it was in Europe, but it might be as much as 10% more patients can end up in that no PE bucket without having to go over there to the imaging side of things. So I'm advocating that it's ready for prime time, and we'll see how this does in peer review. Maybe one of you watching will be one of my peer reviewers, so be kind.
And then, sorry, Swami, just let me know. There was a couple of questions via Twitter. I guess there were people who were watching this, and so if you don't mind, if you guys have a couple minutes.
Excuse me, one comment, one question. So the comment comes from Rick Bodie, who does a ton of research on troponins and chest pain, and he talked about something that we touched on a little bit, so about the heterogeneity of the D-dimer assays, and he basically asked, kind of the same thing that Jeff said, that we should have some kind of an internationalized ratio or something. So basically what he asked was, my point was, heterogeneity of D-dimer assays and the different performances. So could we do it something like the IFCC tables for troponin? And what we would need to know then to do that is how the adjusted cutoff performs for each of these assays and have references to the relevant evidence. So it seems like it would be a lot of work to do it, but it would be helpful if we could use a D-dimer the way we use a troponin, that it means the same thing to everybody regardless of where they are. So I think he's echoing a lot of the things that we asked. The question that I had comes from Min Lekong, and he says, we're diagnosing more PE than ever, but some mortality studies show there's no difference in death. So does the higher D-dimer cutoff equal a worse mortality? I don't know if we have the answer to that question. Put it out there and see what the experts say.
Those are mixed issues. We're diagnosing more PE, and about a quarter or a third of them are isolated subsegmental PE, so we're not even sure what they are. So that's part of the reason the mortality is going down, is we're giving anticoagulants to people that don't need them, and fortunately they survive the anticoagulants that we're giving them. The elevation of the D-dimer assay will actually shunt some of those people away, so we might actually see our mortality rate increase because we end up with a more constricted denominator in that calculation. I think that might be what she's talking about. Fewer people in the denominator that now don't have PE that are doing just fine taking rivaroxaban they don't need. I think that might be the case. See a little bit of an increase in mortality. It's just a statistical anomaly.
All right, guys. I'd like to thank both Jonathan Kirshner and Jeff Klein again for joining us for this journal club. I really, really appreciate you guys taking the time. I know both of you are very, very busy. I know everybody who is listening and who's going to listen to this really, really appreciates you guys taking that time with us.
Thanks. I think we had a comment from Rick Bodie, is that right, a few minutes ago?
Yes, we did.
And I don't know Rick, but I just wrote an editorial about a paper that he just wrote that's published in Emergency Medicine Journal on the use of Gestalt reasoning in acute coronary syndrome. It's a very nice paper, and I was very pleased to get to write the editorial about it. So, hi, Rick. I haven't met you in person. Look forward to it.
All right. Thanks, Salim. Thanks for having us.
No problem. Thank y'all.